Center, parts of the Pentagon, and Flight 93 in the Pennsylvania countryside. And I'm sure there will be lots of sermons that are preached this day on all kinds of things. I think I saw listed somewhere online a sermon entitled something like "What Has 9/11 Taught America?" or "What Has America Learned?" or something like that. And I imagine that there's all kinds, from the full spectrum of the theological outlook of the church, all kinds of sermons from all kinds of angles. And but I didn't want to let it pass, because it is a national day of mourning. And there are a lot of things that have been brought to light, perhaps, and a lot of things that we should be reminded of when we think of this day in the history of our nation. But Solomon actually touches on a number of things that I thought might be appropriate just to remind us of with regard to this day and the things that have happened. If this day is nothing else for you, and it probably is a lot of things depending on your political and economic persuasion, your understanding of world events, your theological bent and persuasion. I mean, there's as many different angles on this as probably there are people. If it's nothing else, it should be a day of mourning. To think, if nothing else, of the 3,000 or so people who were unexpectedly ushered into the presence of their Creator. Perhaps many of them, maybe all of them, went to work as they had so many times before, and that was interrupted and changed forever in a moment of time. But it is a human tragedy, isn't it? And we should not let ourselves, by theology or anything else, become hardened to just the human suffering of what happened. There's a lot of human suffering in the world, and I suppose many of us get callous to it. But we ought to try and enter into the lives as much as possible of the husbands and the wives and the children and the co-workers and the firemen and the policemen and all the different people who died. We ought to try and enter into that sphere of suffering and empathy. We really should. Because we're as human as they are, and as vulnerable as they are, and as mortal as they are. And we should feel for that, just as humans, just as people, just as children and moms and dads and co-workers. We all know those dynamics, and we ought to enter into their suffering in some ways. Solomon's already told us to do that, hadn't he? He told us just a few short verses before we ought to be going to the house of mourning. The wise, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but fools and the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. And this is certainly a day to at least be made more aware and more sensible of our vulnerability as humans, our mortality. And there's a lot of things that may be called into question in our minds and our hearts as we kind of think through this and don't allow ourselves to be calloused. As I was driving over here this morning, I wish I had a TV because I would have liked to have seen this. The memorial, which I haven't seen, I don't know what it looks like, but the memorial that they've made at Ground Zero, I could hear on the radio while I was driving over here, there were pipers and drummers were marching in single file, I think, to the area, and there were some commentators on the radio, and they were trying to paint the picture for the radio of these pipe and drum corps of some sort related to New York firefighters and police department, that sort of thing. Walking in solemnly single file, you could hear the drums being played in cadence as they walked in. And I couldn't stay in my car because I had to come in here and do stuff, but I wanted to sit out in the car and listen to it. but the bagpipes were getting ready to fire up, and they were going to play. And they're particularly poignant in some ways. You know, Scottish pipes are played at funerals often, Amazing Grace or something like that. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe you think they're actually obnoxious or something. But pipes have a way of kind of slicing right through me in some ways, depending on what the tune is. But it was an appropriate, I'm sure, a very moving memorial, and probably opportunities to see it later on TV. But it's good for us to remember our vulnerability, and it's good for us to hear and not be so quick to throw it off on other people, but it's good for us to remember that in the tragedies that took place in Jesus' own day, when they were reported to him, when the Tower of Siloam fell over and accidentally, acts of God, whatever you want to call it, fell over and killed the numbers of people who died there, or in that that abomination of the slaughter that took place from one of the political leaders in that day in the temple, I think, there. When that was reported to Jesus, you remember his words. He said, "Do you think they were worse sinners than you?" It's a rhetorical question. And of course, the answer is no, they're not. And Jesus was leading them to consider the fact that they, his hearers, were as vulnerable and as much in need of repentance as those upon whom the Tower of Siloam fell and that carnage at the temple had taken place. And it seems callous, and it can be thrown out callously, but if we with some humility embrace that and remember that Jesus speaks those words to us, unless we repent, unless our hearts are humbled and in the house of mourning and turning to God and pleading for mercy, we too could likewise perish. And in fact, will one day. Maybe not in like manner, but we will all go to the same place, as Solomon has reminded us over and over and over again. So that's a little bit of a reflection on what has happened. You remember last week we read that comprehensive and weighty passage that reads like this: "In the day of prosperity, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him." And a day like this, as well as so many other days in the history of our country, remind us of the reality of this. And we, as the people of God, who love this Creator, who we believe to be absolutely in control of everything and working everything out after the counsel of his own will, have to trust both in the good blessings and the adversities that come. And we need to be touched by them in our hearts, because that's where Solomon says we are made the wiser, and we will lay to heart the end of all mankind, which has been brought so powerfully and so unexpectedly to us on this particular day, at least. And then one other thing, we'll touch on this today, one other thing I would say to us, that Solomon would say to us: wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. That's a way of saying there's no trust to be found in men. Wisdom from God will actually deliver us. It will protect us and keep us on the way of safety and prepare us for all the things that we know happen in life that we would rather ignore or pretend didn't happen. But wisdom will bring us there, all of its reality and all the truth of it. And wisdom gives strength to a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. You know, the Twin Towers, as an example, in our country, to those outside of our country, were symbols. Well, to us, as well as to those who look at our country, they were symbols of strength, among other things. They were symbols of that place of the world and those towers embodying the economic center of the world in some ways. That's the way the towers were thought of. That's the way the commerce, even the people who lived in those towers and worked in those towers, were representative of all parts of the globe, and the connections of those towers and the commerce that they undertook wrapped itself all around the globe. And so those who destroyed those towers had that in mind in some ways in their ideology. And we're tempted as a people to think we're an indestructible nation, aren't we? We have a tendency to trust in our own strength. We have a tendency to think that our rulers and the rulers who wield the kind of power that we have as a nation, they can protect us. They can watch over us and they can care for us. And they can to a degree, but it's only to a point. And the Bible says that a man is a fool to trust in the strength of a man or in the strength of horses or weapons or any of that other kind of thing, because it is God who raises a nation up and it is God who disposes of a nation. It is God who raises a ruler up and it is God who dismisses a ruler. Those things are hard to remember, and we're often slow to connect the realities of what the Bible teaches us with the realities of our own life, our moment by moment and day by day life. This day reminds us, and it should. And we should go to the house of the mourning. You ought to look at some of the ceremonies that they have on TV. Don't dismiss them as so much Hollywood or grandstanding, that kind of stuff. Maybe there's some of that going on. But just to mark that place where the unthinkable and the unexpected had happened. You remember where you were when you found out about all that? I remember exactly where I was. And I remember staring at that first tower coming down and shaking my head. I couldn't process what I was seeing. It didn't seem real to me. It didn't seem like it was actually possible. So let's be made the wiser for it, and the more dependent upon God, and the more determined to live as faithful people in His glorious kingdom, a kingdom which, blessed be God, cannot be shaken and will not be shaken. That's what I'm looking forward to. All right, let's read a little bit in Ecclesiastes and move on in our study and hopefully our finishing of Ecclesiastes 7. And we finished up that interesting discussion in verses 18, 17 and 18, and let's pick up with verse 19 and read to the end of the chapter. Wisdom, Solomon writes, gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Don't take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And I find something more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among a thousand I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. As we've noted the last couple of weeks, Solomon is pursuing what might be termed these reflections or these observations on the pursuit and the practice of wisdom. We talked a little bit about what wisdom meant last week. And it's good to remind ourselves that wisdom is a sort of a technical term, and it describes the ability to live well. Not just to know what is living well, but the ability to actually pursue it. To the ability, in the metaphors of Solomon, the ability to see the path of wisdom and to actually trot along that path. And to be preserved from falling off one side or the other, to be preserved from the snares that are all along the path of life through which the path of wisdom weaves infallibly with great discernment and great protection. I love the passages in Ecclesiastes and Proverbs that talk about the way that our lives are preserved, the way that fear is diminished when wisdom is our mother and our father, so to speak, when wisdom is the delight of our souls, when we love wisdom that the Bible talks about more than we love possessions, more than maybe even we love our own lives. And when wisdom comes to rest upon us that way and to dwell within our bosoms that way and our minds, then the promises that attend wisdom and the embracing of wisdom are quite extraordinary. But wisdom is that technical and practical ability to live well in the midst of what Solomon says is generally a life full of vanity. A life that he has said repeatedly to us, and even here in this passage we just read, that even he, with all of his wisdom, is unable to trace all the outlines of. And as much as he tried to put things together and added one thing to another, as he said here, as much as he did discover as many of those schemes of the meaning of life that he was able to trace out, he still says of himself, "I said I will be wise, but in my wisdom I discovered that wisdom was far from me." That's a great admission. It's a great posture to have. If it was true of Solomon, how much more true is it, or should it be, of us who, we probably all would agree, have something less than the amount of wisdom and the kind of wisdom that Solomon has? It's a position of humility. It's a position that recognizes, as he says here, that which has been is far, far away and deep, very deep. That's a poetic way of saying everything that's happened in the past, even what we know about in the past, is not understandable by us. We've talked about this before. People who write history, people who study history and write the history of human existence and culture and civilization, the history of anything in the affairs of men. We need to listen well to Solomon's words here, because nobody gets it right. No man and no group of men can stand with any kind of absolute authority and say, here is the interpretation of what has happened in the past of human existence. And here is what would be true, or what's going to be true in the future, based on our understanding and interpretation of what has happened in the past. Who is equal to that task? Anybody? Entire civilizations are ignorant of their own past in some ways. Who has the ability, the knowledge, the scope of reason and observation to be able to include everything that's ever happened and then put it in some sort of interpretive grid to see where the thing is going and what it's meant and what the causes of this event and that situation and this movement and that movement? Who's able to put all that together? And obviously the answer is there is no man. And we respect men and women who have the skills, the scholarly ability, the brains. Sometimes we talk about people having an encyclopedic brain. Photographic memory, the ability to look and read something once and retain it. But even people with that exceptional giftedness and skill still live in some limited slice of time that is ignorant of so many other things. It is impossible to trace it all out. And God has made it that way. He's made it that way so that none of us can ultimately discover what God is doing. One of the reasons he does that is, as Solomon said, he's trying to stoke in us an appropriate kind of fear. And fear is the compatriot of true wisdom, fear of the Lord in particular. Well, so we pick up in verse 19 and we continue on, and I'm always trying to discover, and it's really sometimes very difficult, I'm always trying to discover connections in this treatise in particular. It seems as though Solomon is just all over the place in this thing. It is so hard in this. You look at some of Paul's letters, for example, and he is so reasoned and so logical in some ways, and he's writing to address particular problems, or he's trying to unfold that mystery that had been committed to him in ways that were unique to him as an apostle. But being trained as he was at the feet of Gamaliel, had the best education his day could afford, which would have included Greco-Roman rhetoric and thinking and all that kind of stuff. He was just a master rhetorician and a master logician, and the Spirit of God had put all that together. It's just a wonderful thing to be able to see the movement of an argument of, say, Paul and Peter. But man, it is totally frustrating to read Solomon sometimes and think, what in the world is he saying? And you're just trying to pick him up on one rail and he jumps to another and off he goes in a different direction. So sometimes I feel like I'm fabricating connections, which is always a danger for somebody who's going to teach, because you don't want to make connections that are not supposed to be there. But on the other hand, it takes a little bit of detective work sometimes to see connections. And I think one of the themes, sort of a loose sort of a movement that's moving through this section, 7, 8, and 9, is this common theme, which sort of it's taking note in very general ways of the fallibility of men, the unreliability of men. He contrasts this with the wisdom of God and the infallibility of God in his leading and in the things that he reveals. But in that contrast, through this section here, and as he's sort of laying out wisdom for us, he constantly is contrasting that with the indiscretion, the selfishness, the self-deception, the unreliability, the fallibility of men, whether rulers in high places or paupers in low places. He's constantly giving us this sort of backdrop to help us think and see in the events of people and in the biographies of certain individuals. He's helping us to see what wisdom really is like. And he raises a topic here in this section that we just read, which is kind of humorous. And he raises it in a way that I'm sure makes the eyes in the head of every woman who is sitting here roll. And that is it's just a verse or two where he talks about something that is more bitter than death. And it has to do with you women. And what's so humorous about this is that here's a man who is writing what is arguably one of the most weighty, burdensome books in the entire Bible that deals with some of the most critical questions that we will ever ask and ever seek an answer for, and all we get is this passing glance to women and relationships with between men and women, which is all the more humorous because this guy has 700 wives and 300 concubines. You'd think he'd have learned something in all of that. And it's just, I don't know, it strikes me as being sort of funny and humorous that all he has is a complaint to offer here, a good warning. And under it is a world of theology that I don't know how much we'll actually be able to look at this morning. I'll trot some things out, I think, that are under what Solomon is saying here. but it's just a really kind of a funny, almost sad, tragic comedy sort of a thing that this man who has his life wrapped up in so many ways and so deeply and widely with women has such a horrible thing to say about them and can't find one worthwhile woman in all the women that he's known and can only find, you know, one man of integrity in all of the men that he has known. It's an amazing observation, but we'll get to that in just a few minutes. So that common theme of in these sections here, Solomon kind of noting this fallibility, the indiscretions of men that are common to men, this sort of selfish, self-deceived, self-centered view that men take in this vain world, attempts to find meaning, and this almost utter unreliability of men, which, again, he alludes to or says directly in places like verse 20, which I think verse 19 and 20 in these passages all the way up to the end of chapter 7 here, which is where we'll stop, all have that common theme, and you can see how they're connected together. Verse 19, he'll say, wisdom gives strength to the wise more than 10 rulers who are in a city. And then he follows that by saying, surely there's not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins, which is why wisdom is better than 10 rulers in a city. No matter what the political system, no matter what power is wielded by men and how it's employed, either in oppression or to benefit and advantage, wisdom is always to be preferred, and the wisdom of God is always better and always imparts more true strength and discretion than even the effect of 10 rulers in a city who are exercising great power and all of the privileges of their office, whatever it may be. And I don't have to say this again, but I will. You and I live in a day and age like Solomon did, like everybody has ever lived in any society that has some structure and tries to govern itself in some ways. Men are easily swayed by the charisma of other men, and I use that term generically. And we, because we see men and because we believe men can do things for us, the right situation prevails and the right relationships and connections and networks and all that kind of stuff, we easily gravitate to appealing to and trusting in men to do for us what God specifically commands us to look to Him for. And Solomon knew this. Solomon, one of the most powerful men on the earth in his day, certainly the wisest man on earth in his day, certainly one of the richest men, and he himself, in his assessment of the power and the employment of power by men. And he sort of caps off part of the section when you look into chapter 8 and look at verse 9. Solomon says, all this he's been talking about, all this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done in the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. He's already alluded to this. Oppression, injustice, and those kinds of things happen. And he's the, not totally impassioned, but sort of the unpassioned observer of these things, and it is distressing, it is wicked, he calls it wicked, it is troubling, and yet he is offering to us a better way by showing us the way of wisdom and calling us to that and calling us away from our incessant tendency to put our trust in men and in the societies of men and the things that men can do for us. Government can't fix our ultimate problems, and government is the organization of men in society, agreed upon ways in which we are going to live together and preserve our common good. That's a good thing. But government cannot solve the problems of the human heart. It can address some of those things. It can provide protection. It can execute justice, which is what it ought to do. But addressing the true issues of the heart, man's just not up to the task. He's not able to do it, and God calls us to trust Him and to look in his wisdom, surely as the people of God, if not every person who's ever lived, God commands all men to repent and turn to him. But there's that common theme. There's not a righteous man, and you and I know good men and women, but there's no absolutely righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. And that's such a common truth, we don't even think about it anymore. As I heard one man say, why is it that we say we're only human and nobody's perfect, and we say it as though that's a legitimate excuse? It's a justification for our unrighteousness. It is not. We don't have an excuse. It only works with other people who are as fallen as we are. Nobody's perfect. And all the person that we're talking to can say is, yeah, I know, if they're thinking rightly about it. But it's no justification for us. It's no excuse. The fact that we sin and we don't know half the time what good is an evidence of the fact that we disdain the wisdom of God and the fear of God more than we care to admit. And I want you to see that Solomon connects, and we've looked at this before, in verse 20, he connects his idea of righteousness with doing good. It's not merely a state that we get in, as we commonly think of it today, when we think only of justification and righteousness in terms of the forensic legal declaration. We're tempted, if we're not careful, to think that it's just a state of being and doesn't have any connection with a state of living, with a way of living, but it does. And particularly in the Old Testament, wisdom and righteousness are two sides of the same coin, and the absence of doing good is an absence of righteousness in Solomon's way of thinking. So much of our understanding of God's work and his call through the gospel of us into his kingdom is an understanding and an embracing of what truly is good, what truly is righteous. You know, sin is never an abstract list of bad things that we shouldn't be doing. Sin is always a relational transgression, right? It is always a relational transgression, whether that is to God or whether it is to the person sitting next to you or some person you don't know, but somehow you're a party to some kind of sin that has been exercised against them. It is always relational that way, and so it is always a function of true righteousness that undoes and undermines that kind of sin. It is why in the church we are called to a certain kind of love. And love is not an ethereal, theoretical thing that we know about. It's not something that exists outside of the realm of our experience or even the call of the gospel into the kingdom of heaven. It is the practical reality of a love that we didn't understand before we were brought into the family of God, which now, by the presence of the Spirit, is working its way out and sort of undoing these sins that the Bible talks about. Check out sometime Galatians chapter 5 and verse 19, I think. Look at it sometime. It's that list of the works of the flesh. All those things just sort of rotate in orbit around the Ten Commandments, or to smash it further, they rotate around the two great commandments. And you've heard me say this before, and it's hard for us to work this out. You know, the Bible teaches this. There's really only two laws in all of life. The law of God is only distilled to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Every one of the 639 laws in the Old Testament that were traced out by the Pharisees derived from the Old Covenant, and any of the laws and commands that you find in the New Testament, I challenge you to think about this and how all of them are related to relational transgression and sin, whether that be towards God or whether that be towards each other. That's just the way it is. And it's not as though God is just sitting up in heaven formulating lists of things that he knows we like to do so that he can forbid them. That's not the way he works. If there's anybody that knows what's good and what is pleasurable and what is joyful, it's God, right? If there's anybody in all of the created and uncreated hosts who is all the time happy, it's God. He's a supremely happy being, and he supremely wants us as his creatures to be happy, to know joy, to know satisfaction and fulfillment in life. He does want us to know that. And his law is nothing more than an expression of the condemnation of the ways that we chew each other up and spit each other out, or the ways in which we fail to love the one who is life itself to us. That's all the law is. And that's all the law meant to reveal to us and expose to us. And it's what the law calls us to. It is why love is preeminent now in the new covenant community, because the Spirit of God resides in us, and the first fruit that he produces in the body of believers is what? It's love, isn't it? Love and joy. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, long-suffering, self-control. I didn't get those in the right order, but that's the kind of stuff the Spirit produces, and all that's sort of bound up in love. Faith expressing itself in love. That's what Paul says the whole law is just kind of wrapped up in. That's what really matters, he says in Galatians. That's Solomon's sort of conception of righteousness as he thinks about it, and the doing of good and the never sinning. It's not some sort of internal, inherent, or acquired moral perfection. It is the way that we relate to God and the way that we relate to each other. Now, moving on to verse 21, here's one of those almost comical, if it weren't so true and so hurtful and harmful in our relationships. Don't take to heart all the things that people say, which is exactly what we do. We are always highly offended by the things that people say about us and against us, and hardly offended at all by the things that we say against other people, right? That's just the way we work. That's how we roll as fallen creatures. And Solomon is telling us, look, your own self-assessment is not right, because the truth of the matter is, whether quietly in your heart or verbally with your mouth or in some way, in some action, something that you did or something that you failed to do that you should have done in the looking out for your neighbor or loving God, Psalm said, you've done that. You've done the same thing that you're overhearing, and so don't take it all that seriously, because the truth of the matter is, somebody's going to remind you, or it's going to come to mind, that you know in your heart that many times you've cursed others the same way. And that's always worse than somebody cursing you. It's always worse. Your cursing somebody else is always worse than you hearing of somebody cursing you. It's always more of an offense. And that's the way you need to look at it. That's the way we need to look at it in our marriages. My wife in here? She must be teaching. Good, I can say whatever I want. You know, the longer you live in marriage, hopefully the humbler you're going to get, because you're going to realize the truth of what Solomon just said here. This dynamic in relationships and your marriage is a wonderful posture to embrace. Whatever you hear is not half as bad as what you say. Whatever you hear other people say about you is not half as bad as the ways that you've thought and done other people. That's just the way it is. And if you embrace that as true, you're embracing the truth, and you're embracing grace the way God means for it to operate in your life. If you don't think that's true, or you always think that whatever everybody says about you that you don't think is true or fair is the worst offense under heaven, it just shuts God's grace off. God has nowhere to move into you to change you when that's your attitude. This is great advice for marriage, too. Man, this helps a lot. it'll make your marriage last a lot longer, and it'll be a lot more satisfactory to you if you'll take yourself more seriously this way than you do your spouse. I got one on, men, and I know there's a bunch more to be had out there. I wonder if Solomon was thinking of some of his wives and his concubines. I imagine there was a lot of conversation among Solomon's wives about Solomon. I don't even want to think about it. All right, moving on to verse 23, I guess. Well, verse 21, there's that idea of, I guess we could put that under the category in thinking about men and how fallible they are. There's that sort of self-righteous action going on there. That's really what he's kind of talking about. Don't act so self-righteous. You know, you're guilty of the same things that you are so righteously indignant with regard to other people. Verse 23 through 24, there's this dependence among men. There's this confidence that men have in their own rationality and their own ability to reason and understand. Solomon's already traced this out for us. He's already said to us numerous times, man, I'm trying with everything I got and everything that God has given to me to figure this out, and I can't do it. I've tested what I could test by wisdom, and I still can't fit all the pieces to the puzzle together in a way that's coherent and that I understand with completeness. I can't do it. I said I'll be wise. I asked God for wisdom, and he gave me wisdom that he doesn't give just normally, but still wisdom was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? In chapter 8, he says a similar thing here that we'll get to a little later. I love this passage. I was reading it this week. It was like somebody shot an arrow right through my head. Verse 6 of chapter 8 says, there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavy on him. And verse 5 says, whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way, because there is a time and a way for everything. And a lot, you've heard this before probably, it's one of those little sayings around, you know, timing is what? Everything. And that's used in a variety of settings, but there's a real profound truth with the reality that Solomon laid it out for us in chapter 3. There's a time for everything that happens among men under the sun. And he goes through that litany of a time for this and a time for that. And he picks that in a condensed form. He picks that theme right back up here again. And he says that there is a time, there's a proper time for everything, which means that there is an improper time for some things. And there's a way for everything. There is a just way. And wisdom will bring you into an understanding of both the timing of things and the way of things. And I can't tell you practically how many times I have mistimed something. Something said, something done at a particular time. I have some painful memories in my heart and my experience of saying the right thing at the wrong time. And saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, too. Got lots of experience with that. But even saying the right thing can be said at the wrong time. That's why Solomon says there's a time to speak and there's a time to be quiet. And the right thing said at the wrong time can fall to the ground. When it would be so good to be embraced and heard, it can literally just fall to the ground. The dead silence can make you hear the words fall because of timing. And there are ways in life, there is a just way in life that wisdom sees and embraces and follows after. And it is a protection. He says, you will know no evil thing, he says there. And I've gotten ahead of myself a little bit, but you see how these themes sort of redouble on themselves and redouble back upon themselves. And what he said here in verse 23 is that our rationality and our ability to reason things and even figure things out or even time things is really beyond us. But wisdom will bring us into that knowledge. And wisdom, guarding the heart and guarding the mind, sort of serves as guardrails on either side of the path that will keep us from falling one way or the other and will protect us in ways that we're not even aware of in the time of protection. I love this about wisdom. When we try and think about what the will of God is for our life in a particular situation, often we either have to resort to some kind of weird mysticism or we have to shrug our shoulders and say, I don't really know what the right choice is in this particular situation. And I do want to tell you that this section of the scriptures and the wisdom literature in particular, and now by virtue of the resonant Spirit of God in us, if you love wisdom and you are making it your bosom buddy and filling your mind and shaping your mind with the wisdom that God gives, which is connected to the fear of God, you may not know what to do exactly in a moment in time when a decision confronts you, but I can promise you, you'll be led. You'll be led properly. And in the situation, you may not know how it's going to go, but I can't tell you how many times I've looked back over my shoulder and gone, oh, okay, I get it. I got it. Or look back over my shoulder and say, I had no idea that would happen or God would care for me in that way or lead me in that way or protect me in that way. But that's been the story of my pilgrimage in many ways. And I think I've told you that before, so I won't belabor that point. But often, I only discover the will of God in retrospect. That's a part of discipleship. It's a part of trust. It's a part of trusting that God is going to lead you even when you can't figure out the particulars of a moment. If wisdom is your love, if wisdom is your delight, if your ear is open to wisdom, God will not fail to lead you. He cannot fail to lead you. He would be going against his own word if he didn't lead you, even when you didn't know how he was going to lead you. It's a wonderful confidence. You know, if your heart belongs to God and you're not leaning on your own understanding, all those things we know that the scripture says about wisdom, if that's just your love and your mindset, take confidence. You're not going to fail in life. You're not going to miss God's will for you. Now, that's not to say that we ignore the things that he has said specifically in favor of shrugging our shoulders and just asking God to lead us. When he speaks specifically, we need to listen. And we need to do what he says that we should do in the moment. But when it's a question of this or that and we are not sure what the answer or what the direction is, God will lead as he always infallibly leads. Well, the next thing that he says in verse 25, this string that he's forming here about the unreliability of men and the goodness of wisdom. Verse 25, he says, I turn my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And verse 25, you could read in isolation from what's getting ready to come. But I think Solomon wants us to connect what he just said with what he's about to say. And he wants us to know something about the heart of men. Because we're told to trust our hearts, right? In our society, anyway, we're told to follow your heart and to trust your heart. Your heart's not going to lie to you because your heart is really dealing with what you really want and what you really desire. And that's probably true. And the advice to trust our hearts and to follow our hearts is not completely mistaken. After all, our heart is representative of what we really are in the core of our existence. What really motivates us and what we really desire and what we really want in life, even if we haven't told anybody else, is our heart, our affections, the deep-seated nature of our emotions and even how they express themselves is all connected to our heart. What we really think is true resides in the heart, as Proverbs teaches us very, very carefully. But Solomon is going to put us on notice that our hearts are so easily deceived that they are not completely trustworthy, and that's why, again, wisdom is to be understood and is to be trusted, and particularly in this area that he brings up. He is going to say that a woman who underneath this employs her femininity and her charms and just what she is as a woman, this lovely, created, image-bearing human, which we know as woman, is so, in so many ways, distinct from men in her gifts, in her charm, in her allure, all the things that we think of that we love in the creation of women, in the beauty and the giftedness of women, can be easily turned and perverted. And in fact, this is what Solomon is talking about. He would say the same kinds of perversion can plague men, but it is addressed in a different way and it takes shape differently than women do. But for Solomon, a man who would have known this multiple times over, that there is something more bitter than death, and that is the woman whose heart is nothing but snares and nets and whose hands are imprisoning to a man. And you have to let your mind wander back to Proverbs and think about those places that Solomon talks about prostitutes and adulterers and strange women. He uses that term to describe the woman who drips honey from her lips and uses her charm in a particular way in Proverbs 5 to seduce the simple youth who's hanging around under the street light in the city on the street corner and who is unguarded. He's not a complete fool. He's just unguarded. He's simple-minded. And a woman comes along fully knowing her own heart and her own skills and gifts and her own presence and awareness, and she uses that to seduce him and to, what the proverb says, reduce him to a piece of bread. And Solomon knew the bitterness of this. You have to read his experience with women into what he's saying here. We know that the Bible calls us to faithfulness to one woman and to form those lifelong relationships. But men are of such a nature that they are easily seduced. Men, you know that about yourself? If you don't, you should. If you don't, you haven't fully embraced wisdom as well as you should have. You don't know your own character and your own nature as well as you think you do. Solomon had his head turned many times. Not only did he have his head turned, he was actually enticed to worship gods other than Jehovah by the influence of his wives. Think about that for a moment. That's extraordinary. That is an extraordinary power you wield, ladies. Now, the theology that's all up underneath this, and I see I'm not going to really have time. Maybe we'll throw this hand grenade out another day, another Sunday. But there's a profound and fundamental theology under all of this, and it has to do with the creation of the image of God, or let's say the creation of humans in the image of God. And there are things that maleness and things that femaleness display in the world of humans about God that God has intended to display. He's invisible, isn't he? You know this? God is invisible. He doesn't have a body. He dwells in unapproachable light. You can't see him. He doesn't have arms and hands and legs and heads like we do. But God made us in a way that the way he is knowable by the way you are. And this is so fundamental to you as a created being. It goes all the way to the structure of your body. As a sexually created being, you are in that sexuality a reflector of the image of God. You read it. I'm not making this up. male and female, not just man and woman, not just humans. Male and female, he created them in the image of God. Your maleness and your femaleness is all wrapped up in our understanding and our seeing and understanding of God in his image. It's a wonderful discussion to have. It connects with some really crazy things in the New Testament, this Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to have to think about how I might want to say those things in mixed company. But Paul says them. They're right there in 1 Corinthians 6, for instance, for you to read. And if you read carefully and don't try and change the words to make you comfortable, you're going to see that Paul, through the Spirit, ties the experience of our sexuality to our union with God. But you have to read carefully, you have to read humbly and with reverence. But it's not as though our sexuality was an afterthought or it happened after the fall and God didn't really mean for it to happen. God brought all this out of his wisdom and his own creativity and his determination to make himself known. All that's underneath Solomon, I think, in some ways, it's underneath Solomon's recognition of how bitter this scenario is that he paints and how anti-God this whole thing is. How much against God's desires and his interests are for this situation to develop that he says is more bitter than death. So the heart's not to be fully trusted. It can't be fully trusted. It is so easily swayed. You know, it's probably true that, I don't know, the right kind of bribe might set half of us back on our integrity in this room. It might be true that 70% of us guys in here could be turned aside by the right kind of woman in the right situation. Maybe more. Maybe all of us. That's just the nature of our hearts. Our hearts are fountainheads of schemes. And he ends this passage by saying, "See, this alone I found in my search for integrity, sincerity, purity, among all of the men and women that I have known, I've hardly found one. But this I have found in my pursuit of wisdom and my understanding is that God made man upright, but he has gone after many schemes." He's got, as it were, down on all fours like an animal in some ways and has not borne the image of God in the ways that he was created to. Well, so we'll talk a little bit more about this. I think I probably need to finish there. This little section was sort of bookended, and I'll finish with this little organizational thing here. He begins in verse 23 of this little section by saying, "I've tested all this by wisdom. It's far beyond me." In verse 27, he says, I can't put one thing together with another to figure the scheme of things out. And that's his way of just sort of summarizing and saying, you can't trust in man. You can't trust in your own reason. You can't even trust in the most powerful force operating within you, and that is your own heart. You can't even trust in that. So we got to have some outside source of reliability. We got to have something that addresses us as creatures, unaware of so much that we are unaware of, even the dimensions of our own heart. And somebody has to speak to us and tell us about what's in us. And of course, that's what God does in his addressing us in wisdom. Now, one more thing that's the beauty of this whole discussion, because this is sort of depressing, I think. You know, we're not half the men that we think we are. to speak generically, we're fairly desperate people. We are, as they say, in a world of hurt. And it's good to know in ways that Solomon did not understand that God has addressed our problem. Let's see if I can find this place here. Wrong chapter. But now, the righteousness of God has been manifest apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe, for there is no difference, no distinction. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. In all the ways that Solomon has made us aware of, and all are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be the just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Isn't that good? Faith in Jesus. He's the one whose righteousness avails for us. He's the one, by uniting ourselves to him in faith, who justifies us. And he's the only one we have to worry about, because he's the one who's going to judge, and he judges righteously and justly. So all of these ways that we sin and transgress are remedied and undone and forgiven in our Lord Jesus Christ. In his righteousness, we find our righteousness. In his righteousness, we find our righteousness. It's a wonderful thing that our Lord has done. I love that hymn we sang today that talked about the second stanza of that first hymn. I think we sang in the blue book, said something like, hand me that hymn. Yeah, that's it. 576? Is that, which one? 579? No, that's not the one. What's the other one? Sorry. What is it? 192. I bet that's it. Yeah, that's it. Did you pay attention to that hymn when you were singing it? Man, that thing will kill you. Literally. It'll run you through. Verse 3. You who think of sin but lightly, nor suppose the evil great, which is what Solomon said. Right? Don't listen too carefully what people say about you. We lightly esteem our own sin, but just to get a measure of it, and he's got it right in here. Thomas Kelly got it right. If we suppose the evil's not that great, here may view its nature rightly. Here its guilt may estimate. It's in the cross of Christ. That's where you get the measure of how bad it is, not in relation to somebody else. I can't get a good gauge in my own heart by measuring it against you at all. I'll come out on top in some instances, and I'll come out way in the bottom in others. But if I weigh my own sin and my own lack of righteousness, and my estimation is formed by the nature of his sacrifice and the nature of his awful load. He says it poetically well and movingly. It was an awful load. Not one that we could bear, and if we could bear it, we wouldn't bear it. We would recoil from this faster than anything that you know that moves fast if we were called to this. But there he is, David's son, yet David's Lord. What a mystery. And he's the one who takes away our transgression and puts us upon the path of wisdom, covers and cloaks and guards and guides us with this lovely wisdom which comes from heaven itself. Let's take a few moments just to be still before the Lord, and then we'll have a concluding prayer.